was a couple of Thanksgivings ago when one of those moments when there had been a big credit card leak or information leak online, someone had hacked into a bunch of different stores like Home Depot and Target. And I was standing in my in-law's driveway down in New York, and I got a voicemail from some place in the Carolinas confirming my reservation for a retreat resort that I'd never heard of. And so I listened to it. I thought they must have a wrong number, and I hung up. But then a few minutes later, I got a ping on my phone from my American Express card saying that I'd been charged several hundred dollars from someplace in the Carolinas. So immediately I, you know, thank God for computers too. I'm able to just right away say, nope, this is probably fraudulent. Flag that. Went home. I froze my credit for the next 3 months with the different credit bureaus. I locked down my identity for 3 months to make sure everything was okay. It turns out that it was fine. It was nothing. At the same time that that happened, the youth were booking a retreat, and we used my card to do the down payment deposit. And it just so happened the retreat center's in New Hampshire, but the person who does their bookkeeping lives in the Carolinas. And so it was just this random thing, this random, you know, occurrence that these two things happened at the same time. No one was trying to hack my account or steal my identity. But look, in this age of computers, everyone is worried about identity theft. But this morning, I want to point out to you that identity theft didn't just begin in the age of computers. That it started in a garden thousands and thousands of years ago, when a young man and a young woman named Adam and Eve got confused about who they were and whose they were. They got confused about their identity and had it stolen from them. They forgot they were gods and that he made them, and they lost their faith in him. And from that day until this, we live in a world that is actively trying to devour our faith, our identity in God. You've seen it happen to people. You've seen the young kid who grows up in kids' church singing in the choir. They sing the loudest. They know all the memory verses. They know all the answers to the questions. They go to youth group. They're a leader in the youth group. And then they hit college and they go off to college. And that change in context all of a sudden changes their identity. And they become a whole new person. And they leave faith behind. You've seen it in the young woman who starts her job, a new job, and starts earning money, and all of a sudden, slowly, her identity shifts, and her identity begins to get wrapped up in her work, and it becomes the center of her identity, and God gets left behind. You've seen it in the family that starts to come to church, but then they get caught up in the busyness of school and of sports, and their identity as a family of faith shifts. Instead of living for God, their identity begins to revolve around what everyone else's families revolve around, the school schedule and the sports schedule and everything else. Who we are should not depend on where we are. Who we are depends on whose we are. We live in a world that's trying to steal and devour our faith to make us forget whose we are. So how do we protect our faith, our identity in a world that's trying to steal it? How do we put a life lock on our faith? And that's where the story of Daniel comes in. For the next several weeks, we're going to be walking through Daniel's story, because Daniel had an entire empire, a world superpower, trying to steal his identity from him. And yet he remains strong. And his story is in the Bible so that you and I today can read it and we can learn from it, and we can put into practice the things Daniel did, because he's an example to us, lessons we can learn so that we don't fall victim to this identity theft that robs us of our identity in God, because there are snakes and lions out there trying to steal and devour our faith and our identity in Jesus. And Daniel understood that who we are doesn't depend on where we are, but on whose we are. So let me give you Daniel's backstory. You can turn there in Daniel chapter 1. It's in your bulletin. It's in our app if you're following along on our app and taking notes there. But Daniel chapter 1, and we're just going to read through the first 7 verses together and just kind of get the story. Here's what's going on in Daniel's life. Daniel chapter 1. In the 3rd year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Jehoiakim was a horrible king who led the nation of Israel, of Judah, away from God. All right. In the third year of his reign, which was really bad, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. In other words, he, you know, surrounded it with his armies and kept them there and trapped until they ran out of supplies and ran out of food, and then he took their city. And the Lord, verse 2, delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, along with articles from the temple of God. And these he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put it in the treasure house of his God. That's crazy right there. It's like Babylon steps in, takes over, takes stuff from God's house and brings it to their demon God's house. Verse 3, then the king, King Nebuchadnezzar, ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his court officials, his eunuchs, he orders him to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. And he was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. And the king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. That's the best food. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. And among those who were chosen were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And the chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, he gave the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. Now, I want you to use your imagination here and put yourself in Daniel's shoes. This army invades, takes over your nation, right? They plunder your God's house. What does that say about your God? And then they carry you off, and right there in that moment, your entire future, everything you'd ever imagined about what would happen in your life, who you would be, is just gone and completely changed. 1 minute, Daniel is nobility with a great future ahead of him. The next minute, he's being carried off. He's nothing. He's a captive being taken to a different nation. All his life, Daniel learned to honor and revere God, but now he gets dragged to this new place, and his God stuff is taken and brought to Marduk's house. Marduk was the god of the Babylonians. The story about Marduk is that he ripped his mother in half, and her top part became the heavens, and her bottom part became the earth, right? That's who they thought Marduk was. And it looks like Marduk just beat up Yahweh, just beat God and won. And then I want you to notice how brilliant the Babylonians were, because they take the cream of the crop men and young men and bring them into the king's palace, and they want them to be useful. But how are young men going to feel when you've just taken them from their home and uprooted them and brought them? They're probably not going to want to help or be contributing to your kingdom. So they go through this systematic erasure of their identity and have a new identity installed. That's what the Babylonians set up. So first, they do this through isolation. They take them away from their family, away from their past, and then they castrate them. It doesn't say that clearly here, but through the story you recognize they become eunuchs. They answer to the chief eunuch, and eunuchs were castrated so that they couldn't have children. So effectively, they isolate them by cutting them off from their past and cutting them off from future. All they are now is King Nebuchadnezzar's people, young men. They have no past, they have no future, they only have what this king is giving them. The second thing they do is they indoctrinate them. They put them through 3 years of education, converting their language, their literature, and their religion. All of us know your stories. Think about the stories you know about your grandparents, and many of us, your grandparents who came to this country, or you know, your parents and how they met. We all have our family stories that shape who we are and how we got to where we are today. They replace their stories with all new literature. And they replace their language. Those of you who speak more than one language know that once you're learning a second language, that new language impacts the way you think. So they give them a whole new language, changing and altering their brain. And they give them an all-new faith. They become masters of the Marduk occult, learning all the secrets of the Babylonian gods. So they isolate them, they indoctrinate them, and then they change their identification. They change their names. Can you imagine someone walking into your house and saying, okay, from now on, your name isn't Sergio, it's Satan Spawn? Because that's what they do. All Daniel and the other guys, their names all reflect, say something about God. Daniel's name means God is my judge. They change his name to Belteshazzar, which effectively means Marduk's prince. So now his name means the prince of this demon god. And every time they call him Belteshazzar, and he has to answer, they're reinforcing this idea that, no, you don't belong to Yahweh. You don't belong to God anymore. You belong to Marduk. That's who you belong to. You're his now. The systematic changing, everything they did was designed to convince them that Babylon was the power in this world. They had the power on this earth. They were writing the script of how everything was going to go, and they were in charge of everything. And to show them that by force, and at the same time to lure them into a life serving Babylon by changing the way they think, by making them dependent upon the king for their food. Join our story is what they're telling them. Join our story and live with us and live our way, and then your life will go well and be smooth. Just identify with us and you'll have the best life. That's what everything in their culture was telling them. That's very much like the culture we live in too. Join our story, live like the rest of us are living, and your life will go more smoothly. Make your identity about what the rest of us are making our identity about, and life will go better for you. And as we move through this first part of Daniel's story in chapter 1, we're going to learn three keys to protecting our identity as followers of Jesus in a culture that wants to isolate us, indoctrinate us, and steal our identity. And that first one is this. Remember this. It's a thing to remember. It's remember no matter who is in charge, God is in control. No matter who is in charge, God is in control. Look at verse 1 and 2 again. Just go back and look at those verses. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and he besieged it. But how did he win it? How did he take over Judah? How did he take over Jerusalem? The Lord delivered them into his hands. And the Lord allowed them to carry off articles from the temple. God allowed this to happen. And right away, the first two verses, Daniel wants us to recognize this is a battle between the one true God and these false gods. Between the one true God and this superpower that controls the world at the time, Babylon. It's a fight to see who's really in control. And you got to ask yourself, well, why would God do this? Why would God allow this to happen? Allow his people to be taken like this? And the reason is because Jehoiakim and the people of Judah, the whole nation of Judah and Israel, were wandering away from God. They were forsaking their identity, forgetting that they were God's people, and just going off and being unfaithful. And so God allowed this to happen to punish them so they would recognize who they really were without God and then turn back. And the prophet Jeremiah warned them about this. He warned them, if you don't return to God, this is what's going to happen. And he told them, there's going to be 70 years that you're going to be in exile. 70 years you're going to be in exile. And in that moment when he's telling them that, there's a verse that we often like to quote. We write it right around this time of year. We start to write it in the cards we give to graduates. That verse from Jeremiah 29:11, behold, I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to do harm, right? Well, that's part of Jeremiah telling them the next 70 years of your life are going to be a horror show. And then after that, God will bring you back and restore you. So effectively, if you write that in the card of a high school graduate in the next month or so, or a college graduate, you're saying, the next 70 years of your life are going to be miserable now, but when you turn 88, God's got some plans for you. Maybe find something else to write in their card. But what's in Daniel's mind is a verse, a few verses before that, it's verse 7, and in the midst of warning about being exiled, this is what Jeremiah writes. He says, seek the welfare of the city I have sent you into exile. Where I've sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare, you will find your welfare. Wow. This helped Daniel, this word from God through Jeremiah helped Daniel to remember that no matter who's in charge, God is in control. And I wonder, you know, I don't wonder, I know it, God's doing this today too. God's doing this. God has allowed us to be here in this moment, in exiles, really. If you read the New Testament, you read Peter, you read Paul, the things they write, it's very clear that they see life as we are exiled. We are not home. We are strangers in a foreign land, and we want to get home. We want to be with our Lord. We want to be with God, but we are here in exile. God's put us here. Why has God put us here? So that we could live out the identity as God's children in a place, in a city that does not know God, in a world that does not know God. Why does God want to remind you about this today? There's a reason I'm talking about it. Because God wants to remind you about it. That no matter who's in charge, God's in control. Why do you need to hear that today? What's happening in your life where that's being challenged, where you feel like maybe the way you're being talked to in school by other students or by teachers, that it's picking at your faith and pecking at your faith and tearing at it, and you feel like, oh, well, you know, I'm just going to give in, and you feel like they're in charge. Or maybe at work, maybe people, the way they look at you and talk to you, or a boss talks to you, or at home with a spouse who doesn't believe in Jesus, and maybe the way they're talking to you, you're losing sight of the fact of why God has put you here, and your identity is getting chipped away at. Maybe you're worried about the government and the world governments, and all this is starting to have you question, wait, what's happening? What's happening? It seems like they're all in charge and they've got control. They don't. No matter who's in charge, remember, God is in control. That's the first key. If you and I are going to hold on to our identity, hold on to our faith, no matter who's in charge, God is in control. Then the second thing, resolve. No matter what happens, obey God. No matter what happens, obey God. Daniel 1 verse 8. Let's read through that. 8 to 13. Look what happens next. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and the wine. And he asked the chief official for permission. He says, please help me. I don't want to defile myself this way. And God caused the official to show him favor and compassion to Daniel. But the official said to Daniel, look, I'm afraid my lord the king who assigned your food and drink, I'm afraid of him. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you, right? I've got to give you this food. It's the best food. The king wants you to have this food so you can get strong and be healthy. And if I don't do that and you get sick, it's my head. And then Daniel says to the guard, whom the chief official appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, he says, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. Look, this is not about the best diet, right? This is not about, you know, you should be a vegetarian. That's not what the point is here. This is about whether or not Daniel would obey God or obey Babylon. This is about whether Daniel would violate the laws God had given them about food, the kosher laws, which a lot of us get confused about, and we don't understand how that all works and why these things are given this way. It seems kind of weird. You know, why can't I go into, I did this once, I walked into a kosher deli growing up in New York City and asked for a cheeseburger, and the guy just gave me a dirty look, and I'm like, why can't I have a cheeseburger? You're a deli. It's a kosher deli. You can't put cheese with meat because you're not supposed to cook an animal in the milk of its mother, so they don't put cheese with meat. And I knew that, but I forgot, and I got that dirty look from the guy. And we don't understand, what are these kosher laws? What are they about? They seem so weird. Here's what they were about. They're about preserving God's people so that they don't eat and treat food the way those who worship idols and demons do. And all these laws are about identifying them. Look, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do this with our food or that with our food, because that's what these nations who are worshiping idols are doing. We're going to eat this way. And God gave them those laws so that they could demonstrate, here, our identity is with God. And so when they say, here, we're going to give you this food, and that food isn't lining up with what God has said, Daniel draws the line. And when you find yourself, as we all do, in a culture that is set up against God, how do you keep from losing your faith, losing your identity? Where do you draw the lines? Daniel puts up with the name change. He doesn't stand there and say, no, you're not going to give me that Satan spawn name change. He puts up with the name change. He puts up with the being educated in all the ways of their religion. He puts up with that. He puts up with the new language and the new stories. He puts up with all of that. But then when confronted with doing something that would directly break God's law, Daniel says, no. He draws the line. And we'll see that over and over again in this book. Daniel draws the line at God's commands. He resolves, no matter what, I'm going to obey God. But look at the way Daniel does this. He doesn't stand up and yell, it's my right to eat whatever I want. It's my body. I'll eat what I want to eat. He doesn't do that. In my life, I've found, it's true for me and I think true for a lot of people, the times when we're yelling are usually the times when our faith is the weakest. So he doesn't do any of that. Instead, what he does is he expresses an incredible faith in God and just proposes to this person in charge of him a test. Just test us and see. Watch us and see if, watch us live this out, our obedience to God, and see if this doesn't lead to something better. So Daniel drew the lines where he needed to draw them, and Daniel drew the lines how he needed to draw them, not with bitterness and anger, but with faith in God, that God would come through. I'm sure it couldn't have been easy for Daniel to figure out where are the lines, right? I'm supposed to be seeking the welfare of this place and at the same time not letting it steal my identity. And he's trying to walk this line, but he did it because he drew the lines where he needed to draw them and how he needed to draw them, at obedience to God. I won't do anything that violates God's character. And if you want to know, well, what does that mean for me today? Well, real simple, go read the Ten Commandments and you'll see this is what God's character is like. You honor God, you honor your parents, you honor one another. We don't steal or covet or commit adultery or murder. You'll see what God's like. And then go to Jesus and look at what he says. A new command I give you. What was that? Love one another the same way I have loved you. There's your command from God. I'm not going to do anything that violates God's commands. Where have the lines grown blurry for you, though? Think about that this morning. In your life, as you're trying to hang on to this identity, as a follower of Jesus, as someone who has faith in who God is, where have the lines grown blurry for you and you begin to not be sure? Where are you being tempted to break God's commands so you could blend in, so that life will go easier for you? And where do you need to take a faith stand and say, test me in this, watch me in this, look and see how my faith in God enables me to grow and flourish instead of giving in to these other ways? Watch me and see, can you do that? Could you do that to the people at your work and have them watch you closely? What would they see? Have the lines gotten blurry for you? If we're going to hold on to our faith, our identity, that in a world that wants to devour it, we've got to remember that no matter who's in charge, God's in control. And we've got to resolve that no matter what happens, I'm going to obey God. And then the third key is this one, rely on this, something to rely on. No matter where you find yourself, God is present and will provide. Look at verse 14 on. So now the guard's got a decision to make. Do I allow Daniel and the guys to do this or what do I do? And he, the guard, agreed to this and he tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them all the vegetables and things instead. And to these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. And Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. And at the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, so after those 3 years, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar to see. And the king talked with them and he found none equal to Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered into the king's service. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in the whole kingdom. These guys are newbies, just graduated from Babylonia College. And they're 10 times better than even the best of all the people in his kingdom. See, to most people in Daniel's time, if you traveled to another country, you were leaving your gods behind. That's what's happening in Jonah. You all remember the story of Jonah. Jonah doesn't want to do what God tells him to do. So what does he do? He takes off to go to a different country because in his mind, if I go to a different country, God can't reach me. And so to many people, and probably many of the people who were taken captive with Daniel, in their minds, being taken out of Israel, out of Judah, and brought over to Babylon, meant that they were out of reach of their God, and now just stuck in this world of this other God. But Daniel knows and understands something different, right? The king brings Daniel and these young men into his palace with the goal of winning their loyalty so they'll serve him, right? Give me the best and brightest and put them to work for me. And toward the end, he promised he was going to bless them physically with the best food, He promised he was going to bless them mentally with instruction. He was going to bless them spiritually with all the mysteries of their religion. And he was going to bless them socially by giving them a place in his palace. Royalty among royalty. The greatest empire in the world. That's what King Nebuchadnezzar promised all of them. He was going to make them the best and the brightest and the strongest and the healthiest. Instead, what happens? Even though they're far from home and even though they're surrounded by the best Babylon had to offer, what does he say? God is the one who made them physically strong because they didn't eat the king's food. God is the one who gave them knowledge and understanding, 10 times greater than the wisdom of all the educational system of Babylon. God is the one who gave Daniel spiritual gifts so that he could understand visions and dreams, far greater than we'll see what any of the religious leaders of Babylon could do. And God is the one who gave him a place of honor in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. No matter where you find yourself, God is present and God will provide. Look, we live in a culture that promises physical health, incredible opportunities for knowledge, right? All kinds of spiritual pathways that you and I could travel for enlightenment and betterment and the lure of social connections everywhere. And there are many out there who believe that God is dead and that we no longer need God for any of these things. Everything about our educational system is saying we don't need God for this anymore. Our political system, we don't need God for controlling society and creating culture anymore. That the greatness that we have power to provide everything we need for ourselves, intellectually, physically, spiritually, relationally, all that stuff. We don't need God's presence anymore. And what Daniel's story teaches us is that while our abilities might be impressive, they are nothing compared to what God will give those who trust him, whose identities are found in him. And it also tells us no matter how far our culture wanders from God, God is always present. You never have to be overwhelmed by the darkness of wherever you find yourself. If you're in a work environment that's miserable with people cursing and talking about all kinds of garbage all day long, and that feels oppressive to you, remember, God's there too. And God's not there going like this, my virgin ears. God is there to love those people and win them back because someone's stolen their identity. So wherever you find yourself, God's present. And no matter how far you may have drifted, because some of you in this room, you've drifted. And your identity is now all twisted and turned about all kinds of other things. And you know that this morning. You know that it's all twisted and turned. And you think, you're so far away and there's no way God is present where you are. And I'm telling you, no, God is present wherever you are. Right now, no matter where you are today, God is present. And he'll provide what you need to restore your true identity as God's son, as God's daughter. And I know this. I know this because of Jesus. Because Jesus entered into this dark world. And he's the only one who ever navigated it without defiling himself in any way. Jesus wasn't dragged out of heaven and dragged into this exile here. Jesus willingly chose to enter exile with us. This is what Jesus did so that he could rescue us from exile. And there's no place we can go that he cannot reach. And I know that because of what Jesus did. He came to remind us of who we are and ignite in us a faith again, restore to us our identity. Think about everyone and everything that challenged Jesus to give up his identity, from his temptation in the wilderness to his own disciples abandoning him or being confused, to his own family even challenging and questioning him, the entire nation of people rejecting him, the very people he came to save, rejecting him and killing him instead. Jesus never forgot his identity in all of that, never gave it up to just go along and get along. He remembered who he was no matter what it cost him. That's why Jesus can offer you and I a new identity. A whole new identity, restoring that identity God had for us from the beginning, his sons, his daughters. No longer sinners lost in this world, absorbed into this world, conformed to this world, but sons and daughters of God. And not only that, but Jesus offers us his spirit too, to give us strength so that we can maintain that identity, live out that identity, and shine that identity into the world that wants to tear it away and devour it. So the question this morning for us to ask, who are you? Who are you? Who are you? What's the seat of your identity? What is that foundation of your identity in life? Because whatever is the seed of your identity is what determines how you think and speak and act. Everything you do is determined by the seed of your identity. What's the seed of your identity? If the seed of your identity is your work, then that's going to shape everything else you do because you are your work. If the seed of your identity is sex or sexuality, then that's going to be the thing that defines everything else you do about who you are, and that will come first above everything else. If it's friends or family or job or money or fun or pleasure, whatever's the seed of your identity, that's the thing you're going to protect the most, and that's the thing that's going to drive everything you do. So who are you? Are you a college student who's also a Christian, or are you a Christian studying in college? And studying in a way that honors God because you want to honor God by doing the best you can with what he's given you. Are you a parent who also is a Christian? Or are you a follower of Jesus who's raising the children God has entrusted to you? Which identity comes first? Which identity infects and absorbs all the others? Because if it's your children that you're living for, that means they're the center, they're the ones you worship, and they will tear your heart out. Not because they're evil or bad, but because they're human just like you. But if God is the one who's the seed of your identity, he will give you all you need to raise your children. Are you a business person who's a Christian, or a lawyer who's a Christian, or an electrician who's a Christian? Or are you a Christian who lives to honor God in whatever your occupation is? What identity comes first for you? That is the one that is shaping your life. That is who you're living for. The seed of Daniel's identity is God. Whenever a moment of decision comes, we'll see. He knew very clearly what he would do. He was clear. He knew what to do because he was clear about who he was. And just like us, just Daniel lived in this culture that was trying to devour his faith. So let's learn from Daniel. Let's learn the right lesson from this story too. Because Daniel experienced the victory here, but I don't want you to go out and think, oh, look, if I just trust God, then he's going to give me the victory and everything. Look, Daniel won a small victory here, but where is Daniel living still? Babylon, at the end of this. It was a small victory. It was a victory, but it's a small victory. He's still in exile. His life is still going to be very difficult, and we're going to see him go through all kinds of challenges. But I want you to notice, there's a verse at the end of chapter 1. I didn't put it in your bulletin. I want you to write it in. But at the end of chapter 1, there's a verse. It's up here on the screen. It says, and Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. Write that in. Write that in the app. Write that in your bulletin. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. And here's why that's important. Because the year King Cyrus became king was the year the exile ended. And what this chapter is telling us is that Daniel remained faithful all the way through 70 years of exile. 70 years he went through it without losing his identity. A bunch of us in here are over 70. Only a few of us have been a Christian longer than 70 years. But what if all of us could maintain this identity together and grow in it? Faithful for 70 years. At the end of it all, Daniel made it through this exile because he remembered that no matter who's in charge, God's in control. He resolved that no matter what else happened, he was going to obey God. And he relied on this truth. No matter where he found himself, God was present and God would provide. And one day, our exile will be over too. And we'll be standing face to face with Christ himself, and we'll get there if we remember that who we are isn't determined by where we are, it's determined by whose we are. Would you bow your heads with me, worship team? Would you?